Kenneth Feinberg lays out the parameters for relief to state fair victims. Are they fair? Caught on tape, is Lincoln Plowman taking a bribe in an FBI video? A jobs plan from Melina Kennedy and a school voucher report. That plus the Colts without Peyton Manning and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending September 9, 2011.
Ice Miller, proud to support Indiana Week in Review. The path to a successful business has unexpected twists and turns. The legal professionals at Ice Miller are dedicated to guiding businesses along the journey. Experience takes businesses to the top. Ice Miller can help them stay there. Ice Miller, it's a complex world. Be advised.
This week, Kenneth Feinberg, the man who distributed relief funds to the 9/11 victims and BP oil spill victims, among others, came to Indianapolis. Here's what he said about plans to distribute charitable contributions to victims of the state fair disaster.
I must say I have never been part of a process where the individuals I'm working with from the state fair are very much up to speed on the critical issues. Who's eligible for these monies, these limited resources? Who's eligible? How much money should be allocated to eligible claimants? How quickly can these claims be honored and paid?
Will everyone who was injured in the state fair tragedy be compensated? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel, Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, Leslie Weidenbetter, editor for the Franklin College Statehouse Bureau, and John Ketzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Wish TV Statehouse reporter Jim Shella. Ann Delaney, do Feinberg's words bring comfort?
Well, I mean, it's nice that he's involved in it, and it's nice that he's doing it pro bono, but you don't know any of the details. You don't know what the rate of compensation is going to be. I assume that people who were killed or that people who were seriously injured would be given, you know, more weight, but you don't have the parameters. I don't know how you can draw comfort from that, and you don't know the size of the pool. I mean, are we including just the voluntary contributions in this or the $5 million?
They're being handled separately.
Okay.
He's handling the charitable contributions for the State Fair Commission, and then he's working with Greg Zeller on the $5 million.
Okay. And so my question on the $5 million, is that a charitable contribution? I mean, they surrendered the $5 million without a determination of liability. Is that a gift from the state? And what happens if people opt out of that system and then file suit and there's nothing left? You understand what I'm saying? I mean, if they're not
right,
admitting liability and they put $5 million in that pot, that $5 million is a gift from the state and they still have a $5 million potential on the line, legally.
I don't think it's going to be considered a gift. Do you?
No.
I don't know how you consider it anything else.
Well, and the governor said that, you know, their goal here is to distribute that $5 million as quickly as they can for people that want to take this and move on. I think we should be comforted by the fact that Feinberg's the right guy to be doing this with all the experience that he's had. But the governor also made it clear that if somebody wants to opt out and go to the courts and take their chances, you know, they can do that too. But the problem's going to be it's going to be a long time before you get answers that deal with these court cases. And so, you know, I think they're trying to show some compassion here by making that $5 million available, making it available as quickly as they can.
Jim, your question was, is it going to be enough? And I think no. I don't think that victims, whether they are the families of people who were killed or people who were injured, are going to feel like it's enough. And in these situations, I mean, I don't think that there's no kind of golden rule for how much you're owed if something like this happens. And so, I mean, part of what we're going to have to see is what comes out of all these investigations. Is there anyone else liable here? And what comes from that?
And you heard Feinberg made reference to a limited amount of money. With the large number of people killed and injured, it sounds like that some people may come up with small amounts, if anything.
Well, you know, I mean, what is the value of a life, right? And that's really the question that's being asked, and that's very difficult to answer, of course. But, you know, I hope the state is being compassionate and not trying to limit the losses that it may have from this. Because, you know, you look at the situation in Minnesota, which is another case where you have large liability. They had a $1 million cap, and eventually they came up with a $38 million settlement. So, you know, Indiana here with $5 million cap, now it's not as many people involved, but it's still a significant number of people. You know, I agree with Leslie. I don't think that $5 million as a pool is enough. And, you know, nobody wants to hear that. Nobody wants to talk about that. But I think that's the truth.
Well, and there are a couple of different ways to look at this, too. I mean, it's not the value of a life is hard enough to calculate if they have young children and all the rest of that. But you have people there that are facing multiple surgeries as a result of this. And they could have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars of medical bills, not to mention lost wages and permanent disability. But I go back to my question. You may say that this is not a gift, but there's been no determination of liability, and the state has put $5 million into a pool. And what I'm saying there is that that's not going to absolve them from that $5 million cap if there's litigation from it. Well, so we may be at $10 million already.
I think in the end, though, this is probably not going to play out entirely in the courts. The General Assembly is sure to get involved in something like this, and there might be some kind of deal struck right. where additional money is provided in exchange for
the end
of some of the lawsuits.
The governor was asked this week if the liability cap should be lifted, and his answer was it's premature.
Right, and I stick by what I said here last week when I say it's not going to happen before the end of this short session of the legislature. I just don't think there's enough time for this to play itself
out. So what you're saying is it's not
going
to happen while he's governor.
I think you're looking at down the road. I think that there will be flexibility involved. That's my personal opinion and nobody else's. But I don't think it's going to happen in the time frame that a lot of people want it to happen, which is that it's going to somehow happen before the end of March, so the legislature can deal with it before the session ends in April.
But there may be more than one step to this, too. I mean, we're looking at state tax money.
That could be.
But, you know, the state fair has resources on its own and has borrowing power on its own.
But if you jump to the conclusion it is premature, some of the people that need the help the most may not get the help you're talking about.
I'm not disagreeing with any of that, but
one of the things Feinberg is saying is that this needs to be done quickly.
And I think that's what the states decided with that first $5 million. But what I'm saying is without a determination of liability, you've got the statute there that the state's liable for $5 million. I think that may be an additional $5 million.
Well, and if that's the case, then, you know, that's an, Mike
that's
is exactly right.
Than the
that's
original
a, right. That's, you know, a compassionate move by the state.
Right.
I think it would actually be startling if in the end it was only 10.
Yeah, I think that's true, too.
I think that's true, too. And it needs to be because you cannot have something of this magnitude with the kind of injuries and death you have without helping those people.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question is, how long will it take for the state fair to recover? Your choices are A, 1 to 5 years, B, 5 to 10 years, or C, it will never be the same. Last week's question was, how would you describe Andre Carson's Tea Party comments? 52% said accurate, 43% said outrageous, 5% said unnecessary. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. A former member of the Indianapolis City County Council is on trial for bribery and extortion. Lincoln Plowman, who is also a former Indianapolis police officer, is seen accepting $5,000 from an undercover officer in this evidence video.
I'm going to work hard for you. I might work my bond. I don't have anything else, buddy.
I know, man.
Five?
I know, $5,000. And I know you're going to make it happen for me. I know you will.
Well, you know, there's no guarantees in life, but we're going to give it a shot.
Mm-hmm.
You got one of the best attorneys. You got the best behind the guy. I feel...
Yeah. The audio is not very clear there, but for the radio listeners, the image is he takes a wad of money, puts it in his pocket. Mike McDaniel, when's the last time you saw evidence that damning?
The last time I saw evidence that damning would have been we had a couple of members of Congress, and the video footage almost looked the same, or when Marion Barry was caught in a hotel room in Washington, D.C. This is the same kind of look. This does not look good for Mr. Plowman in any way, shape, or form to me. And I think that's troublesome because we should not have anything like this anywhere in politics or in government. And they're going to have to deal with it and deal with it strongly.
Well, troublesome that it was going on, if indeed he's guilty. But there's some comfort that he got caught, if that's the case, right?
Yeah. I mean, so that it hopefully is not so widespread that maybe this is just aberrant behavior. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure that Mayor Ballard's sorry he promoted this guy in the first place, and he still is entitled to the presumption of innocence on all of this. And the jury's going to decide, but you know, $5,000 in cash being handed over in a hotel room, you know, he hired a very good defense lawyer, and I know he charges a lot. So if he gets off from this, he's worth every penny.
Well, that would be Jim Voiles, and the case that Jim Voiles is making is that Plowman was trying to set up a legitimate side business. Yeah, that's not really the way you conduct business in a legitimate fashion, is it?
Mr. Voiles has his work cut out for him.
I'm surprised there's not a little more outrage here in all this. I don't think it has generated the kind of coverage that I would have expected. I worked briefly and lived in South Carolina where something very similar had happened with a couple members of the legislature. And, I mean, the entire process, ethics and process, was completely revamped as a result, and it was big news. And I realize there's a difference between a city government and a legislature, but I mean, we're not talking about a small city here.
You know, Leslie, I think there's something that's different from that time, though, and that is that I think there's a lot of weariness right now. I think the public is feeling a little overwhelmed. You look at the situation we had with the bank meltdown, and you know, people who were obviously doing things that were illegal and unethical, and the people who were doing those things haven't been punished as a result. In fact, many of them have done very well in this scenario. I think the public has become very cynical about this, and I think that is what's worrisome.
This event took place in 2009. Quite frankly, I was surprised. I'd forgotten that we hadn't had this trial, and when it came up this week, I mean, I was kind of caught off guard by the whole thing. But when you read these transcripts, I mean, I was glad to hear what he had to say about the fact that Mayor Ballard is not a player and not political and not the kind of guy that plays these games. He made that point to the FBI.
You don't think this can work?
I don't think this is. I was glad to read that he said that
because he mentioned a lot of names
in here, and it's going to be interesting to see where else this goes, if it goes anywhere else.
All right. The Democratic candidate for mayor of Indianapolis presented her jobs plan this week. Melina Kennedy stood in front of graphs that show Indianapolis faring poorly in the effort to attract new jobs as she criticized job creation efforts in the Ballard administration.
Over the last few years, our city has lost thousands of jobs.
35,000 is the number the Kennedy campaign uses. It relies on year-end figures, however, that are months old, and the spokesperson for the Ballard campaign takes issue.
You say that's not accurate.
That's not an accurate depiction of what's happening in Indianapolis, no.
The mayor, who attended a jobs announcement last week, would rather talk about jobs that are promised but don't exist yet. This is what he said when he unveiled a jobs plan on August 24th.
The city has just had its best year for attracting new job commitments.
Both candidates carefully choose statistics that support their arguments. Melina Kennedy wants voters to believe that she will provide more leadership.
Using the bully pulpit, bringing the business community together, and never letting her eye off the ball on how important it is that this community have jobs.
Leslie Weidenbender, her plan concentrates on small businesses and entrepreneurship. Will it win votes?
Well, I think this is like a lot of other issues in the mayor's race. How you feel about whether Mayor Ballard has done a good enough job with jobs is whether you have a job and whether you feel like the city has grown economically. And really, I think that most voters aren't going to pay attention to the details of these kinds of plans. They'll be happy that both candidates have a plan, but I'm not sure in the end that it'll sway any votes.
Everybody always says government can't create jobs, and yet we're in a campaign season where every candidate for almost every office, including the president last night, is coming out with a jobs plan. Does the public buy them?
No. I think the public understands that the only job the government creates is the job that is in the bureaucracy. But what government does is can create an atmosphere that is attractive and conducive for the private sector to create these jobs. And that's where we're at right now. We're at a point of stasis, and we don't have an atmosphere where people are have the confidence to make that kind of an investment. Why hire somebody if you can get by with what you have? There's not any optimism. There's not a belief that the atmosphere exists for growth. And so until that happens, and that's where government can come in, government can help promote that kind of confidence with its policies at the federal level on the dollar and on the economic indicators from the Federal Reserve, and on the local level with, you know, tax policy. And we haven't seen anything on that yet.
Both Greg Ballard and Melina Kennedy have put forward jobs plans. They're both vague.
I don't know. I thought hers had some specific points to it. I mean, you talk about a one-stop shop for small businesses. You talk about reducing the regulations and having all the units of government work together to make it easier. I mean, she's run a small business. She and her husband have a successful small business that employs people, and they've made payroll, and they know what it's like to generate jobs in that business. I thought her ideas were very specific, and you know, the figures speak for themselves. We know what commitments are. I mean, we've seen the exposés on television about the commitments that never materialize. It's the jobs lost that makes the difference.
I don't think this campaign comes down to a jobs issue.
No, I don't either. I think the details get lost in the weeds for most voters. I think Leslie's right about the way people see these kinds of things. But you have to talk about it if you're a candidate today, because that's an issue that's on people's minds. Now, her idea about, you know, siphoning off $150 million from the $435 million of infrastructure, it's a jobs killer. You know, we need the infrastructure that was ignored during the time of the Peterson administration. Those are jobs that are put in place to do the work that gets done. And so she's talking about siphoning off $135 million of that. So that's counterproductive.
She's talking about using it for other purposes, like education programs.
$150 million, right? Yeah. And by spreading those out over a bunch of different programs, you don't get the infrastructure, which you need to attract more jobs.
You might be able to drive down the street.
Yeah, well, that's right. And you're
going
to.
Which you can't do at the moment.
At the Ballard administration's paving every street in Indianapolis.
We know that simultaneously. Which is why
traffic is a problem. That's a good thing, Ann. You don't understand
that.
Let's move on. State School Superintendent Tony Bennett revealed school choice statistics this week to the governor's Education Roundtable. 3,685 students received vouchers so they could leave public schools and attend private schools this fall. 85% of those students are eligible for free or reduced lunch. Bennett also reported to the roundtable that there is wide distribution of the vouchers statewide.
And we have 15% of the children from small towns and rural Indiana. So there is a broad geographic spread that says poverty has no boundaries in Indiana. But we also are saying that demography does not determine a student's destiny.
Objecting. John Katzenberger, is that success?
I think in the eyes of the people who are for the vouchers, it is. I think that the numbers exceed what they intended or thought that they were going to get, even in a best-case scenario. And, you know, they're looking at possibly filling the 7,500 slots next year. So I think in their eyes, it's success. I think it's yet to be determined, because we don't know the effect of the vouchers on the overall funding formula and what kind of ramifications it'll have in terms of, you know, the equity in the formula.
I think it is evidence of some pent-up demand. Because, I mean, people did not have very much time to put all of this together. I mean, it was only passed in April. The bill was signed in May, and the Department of Ed, it took them quite a while to get everything together. I mean, right. And I say quite a while, meaning a few weeks or a month. And so people didn't have much time to get out, choose a private school, get organized. And so I think it's kind of an impressive number, as you said, you know, if you think that vouchers are the right way to go.
He was praising public schools as well for cooperating. There's an effort, it strikes me, from the State House to smooth over differences.
Well, you have to have that kind of cooperation. I mean, look, you know, when you're giving people choices, and this program, I think, is off to a great start, because the program was only 60 days old, as Leslie just pointed out, you know, and to have half of those vouchers go in the first year was pretty amazing to me. And with 85% of those folks being available or eligible for free or reduced breakfast and lunch, that tells you that it's going to the people that the legislature's intended it to go towards. And I think that's pretty impressive.
Opponents impressed by this, do you think?
Well, I think the same percentage, something like 85% of them are going to religious schools. So you have a huge transfer of assets from public schools to religious schools. And it's interesting that the South Bend judge just declared unconstitutional an attempted transfer from the South Bend School District of a school to a parochial school, saying it's a violation of the church and state provisions. This is the same thing. And it's going to be interesting to see how it winds up getting litigated.
Three office buildings in downtown Anderson are for sale on eBay this week. The First Merchants Bank Tower, the Union Building, and this building at 11th and Jackson are on the market because the current owner, California investor Albert Gulikoff, can't afford the taxes.
We have roughly $200,000 worth of taxes on the three properties.
The taxes on the Union Building, for example, went from $11,000 one year to $65,000 the next. It's due to property tax reform in Indiana and the property tax caps that keep residential taxes low, as well as a loss of commercial properties in Anderson.
Couple that with the economy that has turned down and a real estate market that's taken a really big hit. Kind of a perfect storm.
And so now you can find pictures of all three buildings on eBay. They provide most of the top office space in downtown Anderson. As he looks for a buyer, the owner is also appealing his property tax bill.
More than 25% of the gross income from the properties is going to the taxes.
Realtor Gene Clarkson there, Ann Delaney, is that the downside of property tax reform?
No question about it. I mean, you've got rental property at twice, and you have commercial property at three times, and no one's ever asked the question of whether or not to get to the three times, do you have to be at the one for individual? Can you be below the one ceiling and be three times the amount for commercial? The question is whether this is going to start popping up. Is this the canary in the mine shaft, or is this just an aberration in Anderson? But if it's the canary in the mine shaft, this is going to be a big problem for business.
Well, Anderson is a community that's lost a lot of commercial property in recent years, so they're probably in a different circumstance than a lot of communities. But will this happen elsewhere?
Well, sure, it's going to happen elsewhere because different communities are affected differently. But, you know, you take a look at the fact that the property tax issue drove at least two election cycles in Indiana. Mayor Peterson probably lost in good part because of it when nobody thought he could. There were some pretty dramatic things that happened as a result of this debate. It has died down so dramatically because most Hoosiers are satisfied with the fact that their property taxes are a lot less than they were. And so you're going to have a hard time reversing anything that is as popular as what's happened with the property tax burden.
But, Leslie, do you think lawmakers expected to hear this sort of story this quickly?
Well, I think this is a very confusing situation. I don't think this was caused by the caps. I think that it is being sort of misrepresented as being caused by the caps. The caps keep your property tax bill from getting higher. Or beyond a certain point, I'm sorry, not higher, but beyond a certain point, but the caps in themselves would not raise your property tax bill. So this is more of a situation of when they raised the sales tax and there were a number of other changes made, and I do think lawmakers expected that would impact counties differently.
I don't think that's completely right. Because, for example, on some of the commercial property that we own, the property taxes have gone up because they're now twice what they were as an individual.
But that wasn't because of the caps.
Well, it is because of the caps.
It's because the government needs money and because the residential portion is being held down.
They can't move the residential portion. They're moving the other two portions. That's why it's happening.
If there's room under the cap, there is definite possibility that you could have some creep as a result in the other categories.
Yeah,
and that may be
I don't think the creep is caused by a cap elsewhere.
It could be.
Finally, for the first time since 1997, the Indianapolis Colts will start the season with a quarterback who is not Peyton Manning. Manning underwent his third neck surgery this week and will be out for months. That means his streak of 208 consecutive regular season starts is over, and it means Kerry Collins is the new quarterback.
I've been doing this for a long time, and I know what it takes to get ready to play. And certainly, you know, in no way do I think that I could replace someone like Peyton, you know, and what he means to this franchise and the city. But at the same time, I have been doing this for a long time, and I guarantee that I will bust my butt to get ready to play this week.
Mike McDaniel, will the Colts ever be the same?
Yes, I think they can be. I mean, this team won more games in the last decade than any team in the NFL. And a lot of that had to do with Peyton Manning. But it's still a nucleus of a very, very good team. And they're going to win a lot of games. We're spoiled by the fact
we've done it. You think Peyton will come back?
I do think he'll come back.
Yeah.
This year?
Yeah.
No, not this year.
Well, I'm more optimistic. I'm always more optimistic than Mike.
Indiana Week Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, Leslie Weidenbender of Franklin College, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/podcast, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity. Just go to Hoosier TV and look for Indiana Week in Review under News. I'm Jim Shella of Wish TV. See you again next week.
Ice Miller. Proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Things can go wrong in a thousand different ways. Businesses need a law firm that knows the thousand and first. The team of legal professionals at Ice Miller is committed to helping put the pieces back together. Ice Miller, it's a complex world. Be advised.